Today is April 18th, Sunday morning, our last class in Masechet Rosh Hashanah. We're in the last chapter, which is chapter 4, and the last two Mishnayot are 8 and 9. So we looked last time extensively at most of the last Mishnah, which is Mishnah 8, Mishnah Chet, and in the Albek here to the bottom of 323. And what we didn't do is the last section of the Mishnah, which seems to be unconnected to the material in the Mishnah we talked about last time. And the last section is 15 words at the end. It begins with the words, Ein Ma'akvin. Ein Ma'akvin. Etatinokot Milikoa. David, do you?
I'm with you.
Okay. So it says, Ein Ma'akvin Etatinokot Milikoa. Aval mitaskin imahen ad sheyilmodu. Vamitasek lo yatsa, vashomea min hamitasek lo yatsa. So, what it means is, to be going back to the beginning that I just read, Ein ma'akvin, we do not hold back, we do not prevent, et hatinokot, the children, mei litkoa, from to blow. That is, we don't prevent kids from blowing. Aval, but mitaskin imahen ad shiyil modu. But we're mitaskim with them until they learn. Now, how exactly do we translate that word mitaskin? So the root is ayin samech kuf.
Osek? Yeah.
Right, osek, which
osek
means
Torah, to engross or involve.
Right, to be involved in, to be engaged in. Right. So here it's in the reflexive, lehitasek, which is very similar, to be involved in. So a good translation might be, rather we get involved with them until they learn. So you don't prevent the children from blowing the shofar, but you get involved with them, which would mean that you teach them, that you show them, that you play around with them, that you get on your hands and knees and do things with them, assumedly even blowing the shofar and holding it and showing them, ad sheyil modu, until they learn.
I think about, is it a Mishnah Lasok that we say every morning?
Lasok
B'divrei Torah. Torah. So it involves. So the word means even more than involve. It's a deep.
To go deep into it.
Right.
Although in this case, it's hard to see how there's any deep involvement with the kids until they learn. Right? And again, it is. It's not the same form. It's not lasok. It's not as simple. It's lehitasek. I have a funny story with this word here, tinokot, which means children. Clearly here, tinokot doesn't mean infants, because you can't teach an infant to blow the shofar. But in modern Hebrew, the word tinok means an infant. But in Mishnaic Hebrew, it means a minor, someone up to the age of 13. So many, many years ago, I brought my tefillin to a sofer to check if they were kosher. And there was a certain problem with the parshiot, a certain question, and the sofer told me that I should go to Rabbi Scheinberg and ask him what he thought of the parshiot. So the sofer opened them up, gave me the parshiot, said, show them to Rabbi Scheinberg, who was a very famous rav then in a yeshiva called Torah Or, in one of the northern neighborhoods of Jerusalem. So this was a Haredi yeshiva, and I wasn't at all connected to the Haredi world. So I remember that one Friday morning, in jeans and sandals, I went up into the yeshiva, in the sea of black, and after the tefillah, in great trepidation, I went up to the Rosh Yeshiva, and I said to him, here I have these parshiot that scribe said to show them to you. So he looked at them, and he told me what to do. But I couldn't understand his Yiddish accent. He was talking English with a Yiddish accent. And I asked him again, and I didn't understand. And I asked him again, I didn't understand. What he had said to me was, show them to a tinuk. Now that a tinuk is a tinok, which means a minor, I had no idea. Even if I had heard that a tinuk is a tinok, I would have thought it means show it to the infant. What's he talking about? So I was extremely embarrassed. Here's this very important man telling me one sentence. I can't get a word he's saying. And I walked out of there not knowing what he said. I had to piece it together afterwards from people that I asked. It's tremendously intimidating, not because only of the circumstances. He's known, he's a very, very small man who looks very, very, very heavy. And the story is, he wears over 200 pairs of tzitzit. One begged...
I've heard about him before, I guess.
So
or maybe there's multiple people.
It's very intimidating. It's this little guy with really big, and all of these tzitzit hanging down. And, of course, around him are all these doting talmidim that seem to be, you know, really, really worshipping him. And I can't understand the words. Anyway, that's how I learned that tinoch means a minor. So, then it says, v'mitasek lo yatsa, v'shomea min ha-mitasek lo yatsa. So the mitasek didn't fulfill his obligation, and someone who hears from a mitasek doesn't fulfill his obligation. So we clearly see here that the word mitasek, in this part of the Mishnah I'm reading now, is the same word that appeared in the first part of the Mishnah, where mitasek meant someone who is involved with the students, the kids, until they learn. But the word can't mean the same thing here, because there's no children here. Here it says, the mitasek lo yatsa. So the mitasek must be someone who's blowing the shofar, but he's called the mitasek. And then it says, the shomea min ha-mitasek, and someone who hears the blowing of this person lo yatsa. But it doesn't say he's mitasek im. He's dealing with someone. He's just called the mitasek. So on the one hand, the word means something different than the other appearance of the word. On the other hand, clearly, what ties together these two phrases is the same phrase. The Mishnah is doing, it seems like, a kind of play on words here. What mitasek means in this second appearance, mitasek is a halachic category of someone who does a mitzvah just while being involved in something else. He does it accidentally. A mitasek leyatza, and someone who is fooling around, or someone who is just dabbling, lo yatsa. And someone who shomeirs from the dabbler, lo yatsa. So the similarity is that the someone who's mitasek with the children, he's not intending to do the mitzvah, he's just showing them how to blow. And then the second use of mitasek is someone who's just fooling around with the shofar, and a sound comes out, and lo yatsa. What exactly it means, just fooling around or just dabbling, we'll have to talk another few minutes. So anyway, that is the very, very basic framework of the this part of the Mishnah. Now we have to go back and understand more deeply. So I'm going to go through it with the questions. We already talked about the fact that there is one word in the section of the Mishnah that seems to be used in two different senses, and that's the word mitasek.
But couldn't it be that, I mean, couldn't they be related in the sense that we've just told you can go ahead and have the child play around and try and blow and so on. But if he does it, that doesn't count.
He is the child.
The child. You happen to be there. He's in another room and you've heard it. You can't. He hasn't fulfilled an obligation. He was just practicing. He was just trying it. And you've just heard him and he got it right this time.
But...
Because he is, we've just said, get him to do the work
right
at it, however we want to translate that. And now he is that one, he's working at it, practicing.
Okay, but notice that in the first part of what we just read, the mitasek is the word that applies to the teacher. Whereas in the second part, the mitasek applies, according to you, to the student.
Uh-huh.
So that's a little bit of a discrepancy.
Okay.
Because really I would say that the student is not a mitasek. He's purposely trying to blow the shofar properly.
Uh-huh.
Right. He's not just dabbling, teaching, involved in. So that I don't think that's the direction to go in.
Okay.
The second matter was divide this section of the Mishnah into two sections, and that's clearly the first part talks about the tinokot, that we don't prevent them from blowing, but we help them. And the second part is something completely different, that when you hear the that when you blow the shofar, and you don't intend to do the mitzvah, or you hear it blown from someone who's not intending, lo yatsa. The only connection seems to be linguistic. So the next question we have to answer, what would appear to be the meaning of the word aval here in this part of the Mishnah that I made a point of not giving away when I translated it 2 minutes ago? What does aval mean? Aval, of course, usually means but what does it mean here?
Seems to mean rather.
Rather, right, that's what it seems to mean. It seems to mean rather, certainly, or even a little bit more strongly, indeed. Right. Rather indeed, not only don't we prevent them from blowing, the opposite, we work with them to teach them.
Yeah.
We work with them, we're mitaskin. So here, aval means rather or indeed, and the truth is that in medieval Hebrew that became a major meaning of the word. In modern Hebrew, we say ela. But means aval, or aval means but, and ela means rather. But in medieval Hebrew, whenever you see the word aval, it most usually means rather. But in the Mishnah, this is a rare usage, that aval is meaning ela, rather. Okay. According to the content of this section of the Mishnah, and according to its immediate context, do you think that it's talking about Rosh Hashanah that falls on Shabbat or not? So first, as far as its content, right, is it talking about Shabbat? Well, all we could say is it doesn't say Shabbat.
Right.
It doesn't say Shabbat.
Well, I thought a shofar is muksa.
On Shabbat.
And so it would be extraordinary if we were talking about Shabbat.
Right, exactly, exactly, exactly. And in the context of the Mishnah, we had all of these gzerot, all of these rabbinic decrees, where it said on Rosh Hashanah, you don't cross over the water for the shofar, and you don't get it out under a rock pile, and you don't go up a tree to get it, and it wasn't talking there about Shabbat. That doesn't say Shabbat at all. So for all these reasons, it wouldn't make so much sense for it to be talking on Shabbat, and the context is not Shabbat, and the content doesn't mention Shabbat. I just wanted to emphasize that it doesn't seem to be talking about Shabbat. The Gemara says it is, but the Gemara doesn't seem to be the pshat of the material. There's no mention here of Shabbat. But if there's no mention of Shabbat, then we have to ask ourselves another question. What is the Hava Mina? Why say that you don't have to prevent yourself, you don't have to prevent the kids from playing with the shofar, why say that if it's not Shabbat? On Rosh Hashanah, why do you have to say that you don't prevent the kids from playing? Is there any reason to think that you would have prevented the kids from playing? Well, there is a reason. Just like the gzeirot we saw above, that says you don't climb a tree to get to the shofar, and you don't ride on an animal, and you don't swim on the water, all those gzeirot of Shabbat, we don't swim, we don't ride an animal, but they apply to Yom Tov as well. So the same thing would appear as far as the gzeirah, that we don't play musical instruments on Shabbat, also on Yom Tov, we don't play musical instruments. Right, we've never seen a service at Shari Tefillah in which we play musical instruments on Yom Tov, the Gzeirah, just like you don't ride an animal and you don't swim and you don't climb a tree on Shabbat, and also you don't on Yom Tov, so on Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Tov, you don't play a musical instrument, lest you come to fix it. And fixing it is just as forbidden on Yom Tov as on Shabbat. So you might think that you are supposed to prevent the kids from blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. because it's a rabbinic zerah, just like you prevent the kids from swimming or from riding an animal or climbing up a tree. Ah, but if there's a zerah of playing an instrument on Rosh Hashanah, why do we blow the shana, the shofar on Rosh Hashanah? Ah, well, that the Torah commanded. If the zerah doesn't come to say you should never blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah because it's a musical instrument and it's forbidden by the rabbis. When the Torah tells you to do it, you do it. But the question still arises, if you're not doing the mitzvah of shofar on Rosh Hashanah, but you're just hanging out with your kids and your kids want to play the shofar, well, should you say, no, don't play the shofar on Rosh Hashanah because it's Yom Tov and musical instrument playing is forbidden? Or do you say that since it's the mitzvah of the day, then you can and even should get involved with the kids with the mitzvah of the day, doing what they want to do, which is fool around and play and perhaps get a sound out of it? So piecing these things together, that might be what's behind the Mishnah that says you don't prevent the tinokot from blowing, which indicates there must have been an opinion that you do prevent them, but the psak in the end is you don't prevent them. And the opposite is the case, that you're even allowed to play around with them until they learn. So I guess that that would get them into the spirit of Rosh Hashanah and have them feel some connection, even though there's rabbinic zerab not playing a musical instrument, but this is the mitzvah tayom. That seems to be the pshat of things, right? This is not what the Gemara says, but that seems to be, I think, the straightforward way of learning it. So that was question five. That was question four and question six. Question five is, according to what we have already learned in this tractate, but Rosh Hashanah that falls on Shabbat, and we learned that Rosh Hashanah that falls on Shabbat, you don't blow the shofar lest you carry it for a moat. So that's another reason to think we're not talking about Shabbat, and indeed we're probably not talking about Shabbat. And then six and seven was, why would you think to refrain from teaching the kids, and why would you be allowed to teach the kids in the end? That's what we talked about. Yeah. So now, and the shofar, right, it is not muktzeh on Rosh Hashanah. You have to pick it up to blow it, and you can't pick it up for other reasons to take it home. Since it's the mitzvah tayom, even though there's no playing of musical instruments on Yom Tov, we allow playing the shofar in all contexts on Rosh Hashanah, even with the kids. Okay, and now we get to the second part of the Mishnah, this matter of the mitasek. So I'll read it again, the second part of the Mishnah. Va'mitasek lo yatsa, va'shomea min ha'mitasek lo yatsa. So the mitasek is someone who is just going through the motions. He's just mitasek. He's just involved with the shofar, but he doesn't mean to do the mitzvah. And here there is a very, very big question. What level is the mitasek with the shofar at? There's two ways of understanding it. The mitasek could be someone who is blowing on this musical instrument. He doesn't know it's Rosh Hashanah, or he doesn't know there's a mitzvah on Rosh Hashanah to blow, or he knows all those things, but he doesn't mean to do the mitzvah because he's not interested in it, because he did it already, or thinks he's going to go later to the Beit Knesset. He's trying to get a sound out of this instrument, but he doesn't intend for the mitzvah. He's just mitasek. And then it says lo yatsa. And why lo yatsa? Because he didn't intend to do the mitzvah. And we'd say that means mitzvot tzrichot kavana. Mitzvot require kavana. But there's another way of learning it completely. Yet a mitasek is someone who doesn't even intend to get a sound out of the shofar. He's just, for example, cleaning it. He's just mitasek with the shofar. He's just fooling around with the shofar. He's involved with the shofar. And mistakenly or inadvertently, he gets a sound out of it. And the Mishnah is saying, in that case, we didn't even intend to get a sound out of it, and the sound came out inadvertently, lo yatsa. And then you would say, if the Mishnah had to tell me that lowly case of the mitasek in which he didn't even intend to get a sound out of it, lo yatsa, that would probably indicate that if he did intend to get a sound, even if he didn't intend it to be the mitzvah, then yatsa. And now we prove that mitzvot lo tzrichot kavana. And this is the center of a debate that is involved with a lot of different Talmudic passages, Mishnaic passages, and it's been going on for 1,000 years, and it's the question of mitzvot tzrichot kavana or not. And this Mishnah plays a central role, and it proves one or the other depending how you understand the mitasek. Now, looking at it, just with the textual evidence we have, do we see any points to pull in this direction or that direction? Well, a simple thing you can say is that if the Mishnah was simply talking about a case of lack of kavanah for the mitzvah, it should have said that. Because we did learn a Mishnah a few weeks ago that was talking about lack of kavanah for the mitzvah, and it said what it meant. It didn't use the term mitasek. But I have it here on the sheet in B. Good morning. I have it here in the sheet in B, and this is a Mishnah we learned about 2 months ago at the end of Perek Gimel, and it says, V'chein mi shaya over achorei Beit HaKnesset. And so someone who was passing behind the Beit HaKnesset on Shana, O shaya beito samuch la Beit HaKnesset, or his house was near the Beit HaKnesset, V'shama kol shofar, or he heard, and he heard the sound of the shofar as he's passing by, or as he is living in his house, O kol Megillah, or the same thing with the Megillah on Purim. He's passing by the Beit Knesset, or he lives near the Beit Knesset. Im kivein libo yatza, if he intended his heart for the mitzvah, yatza. Vim lav lo yatza, and if not, lo yatza. Afal pi shezeh shema vezeh shema, even though this one heard and that one heard, or even though the people in the Beit Knesset, they heard, and the people outside the Beit Knesset heard, but still, Ze kivein livo, ze lo kivein livo. This one intended his heart, this one didn't. It all depends on kavanat alev, on the intention of the heart. So here's a case which we're not talking about the blower, we're talking about the listener. Right? That's a distinction we have to keep in mind. Not talking about the blower, but about the listener. But we're saying that the listener requires kavanah. And if he doesn't have kavanah for the mitzvah, lo yatza. And that would teach us that mitzvot tzrichot kavanah. Mitzvot require kavanah, the kavanah of doing the mitzvah. So now, our Mishnah, that's not talking about the listener, but about the blower, right? If it wanted to say the same law that we learn in the Mishnah we just read in chapter 3, Mishnah Zion, of Kavanah, it could have said that someone who blows the shofar, im kivein libo yatza, im lav lo yatza. Why did it use this language of mitasek? A different language. And we think the reason is because it's talking about something else. It's not talking about someone who's blowing for a sound, and the question is it for the purpose of the sound of mitzvah or not? If it meant that, it would have used the language of mitkaven. Rather, it uses different language, probably because it's talking about something else. It's talking about someone who didn't even intend to get a sound out. He's just fooling around with the shofar. He's cleaning it. He's polishing it. He's trying to blow through it to get the saliva out, and a sound came out. Then the question is, yatza or lo yatza, and it says lo yatza, which is telling you that if you didn't intend to bring the sound out, then it's not a sound that can be considered for the mitzvah, lo yatza. But that would indicate that if he did intend to make a sound, even if it wasn't for the purpose of the mitzvah, then perhaps yatza. Now, if you follow me one step further, according to what I'm suggesting the pshat of our Mishnah is really in conflict with the pshat of the Mishnah we read 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago. Right? Because the one we read 2 months ago said it all depends on kavanat alev. Yatza or lo yatza. Whereas the one we're learning today seems to say it depends on something more basic, if you intend to get the sound out or not. And if you intended to get the sound out, yatza, if you didn't intend but it came out inadvertently, lo yatza, that would indicate that You don't need kavanah for the mitzvah.
You don't need kavanah of fulfillment of the mitzvah.
For the fulfillment of the mitzvah. All you need is kavanah to get a sound out, which is not called kavanah. That's just called blowing.
The act is intentional.
The act is intentional, but not the mindset of it. Right. So, but that's in conflict with the Mishnah that we learned last time. Two months ago. Because there it says it all depends on kavanah to live. So, can we live with that contradiction? Well, I think that's the pshat. There's a contradiction. The pshat is there's a contradiction. Can we find a solution for the contradiction? Well, we can point out that our Mishnah is talking about the blower. The other Mishnah is talking about the listener. Can we make a distinction there? Can we say perhaps that in the case of the blowing, as long as you had intention to blow, that's enough. Don't need attention for the mitzvah. But as far as the listener, there you need more. There you need not only intention. There it's not enough that the sound is a mitzvah. No, there it's not enough that the sound was intended to be blown, but the person who's listening, in order for him to latch onto that sound as a mitzvah sound, he has to have intention not only to hear a sound, but to hear the sound for the purpose of fulfilling the mitzvah. You hear what I'm saying? Or should I? It's okay? That's a suggestion. And the suggestion I just made is a suggestion of Rav Avram ben Arambam. Because the Rambam seems to contradict himself. The Rambam brings both of our sources without further explanation. And again, if we take both of our two sources, on their simple level, they seem to contradict each other. Because to say it one last time, the source from 2 months ago says that you need kavanah for the mitzvah. And the Rambam brings that. But our source today just seems to say that you have to intend to get out a sound, which would imply that then you filled the mitzvah if you intend for the sound, even if you didn't intend for the mitzvah. The Rambam brings both of them without further explanation. And the commentators, how could that be? He's contradicting himself. So Rav Avraham, the son of the Rambam, was asked this question. He said, I'll tell you what my father meant. My father meant to distinguish between blowing and listening. And it really makes a lot of sense to make that distinction. Because the blower
knows he's about to blow.
As long as he knows he's about to blow, then that's enough. It's a shofar sound. But someone who's removed from that, he's not involved. He's just passing behind the Beit HaKnesset. He needs a further level of connection to what's happening in order to fill the mitzvah. Because again, he's just listening. He's not blowing. He doesn't have the shofar in his hand. So for him, says Rav Avram ben Arambam, for the listener to connect to the mitzvah, that requires kavanah, that this listening is the listening of mitzvah, but you don't have that same requirement for the blower. For the blower, all he needs is to know that he's blowing. That's, now, I don't mean to say that Rav Avram ben Arambam's approach was accepted. Not necessarily accepted in explaining the Rambam, and certainly not accepted lahalaha. But if we're trying to understand the pshat of the material in front of us, then that might be the best way to do it.
So it seems somewhat arbitrary, but I guess there's a degree of passivity that he can still fulfill the mitzvah with, and an even further degree of passivity that, you know, that there's a line drawn between those two. Is that correct?
Okay, but we could, I think I can say the same thing you're saying come from the other direction. There's a certain degree of activity that's involved, that's needed when I'm the blower, and a greater degree of activity connection when I'm the listener, because I am far removed from the thing itself.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the same thing as what you're saying,
case,
right?
Yeah, in neither case is somebody starting with the from the point of view of fulfilling the mitzvah.
Right.
And it's just matter of circumstances.
Well, the person who's listening, he has to intend to do the mitzvah.
Right, but I'm saying, so there, if somebody is walking by with no intention of fulfilling the mitzvah, they have not fulfilled it despite the sound being...
Right.
You know,
even if they heard the sound from the Beit HaKnesset, which was blown by someone who intends to have the mitzvah fulfilled. But for the person who's listening to it, to connect to that, he has to intend for that connection.
Well, so this could be somebody standing right next to the person in the Beit Knesset on Rosh Hashanah, but thinking about something else.
Right.
I see.
Right.
Okay, versus, so, okay.
Unless you say that the fact that you entered into the synagogue indicates a certain level of willy-nilly desire to do the mitzvah. So if you forget about that intention while you're listening, that doesn't matter, because the fact that you entered into the synagogue, that's an umdana. That's it's a fact that, how do I say this in English? The being there is an indication of the kavanah.
Mm-hmm.
Passive kavanah, okay. Call it. Passive kavanah.
An
umdana is a legal assumption. Legal assumption. Mm-hmm. Someone who enters into a synagogue in Rosh Hashanah, we assume that he's going there to fulfill his mitzvah of shofar. So even if you would do a brain scan on him while he's listening and say he wasn't paying attention, but that's why he came to the synagogue, that's enough of an umdana to say that. Can you imagine the development of halacha in 2,000 years? They're going to do brain scans to see if we had covered after the mitzvah.
You know, if you said, if you just said, some kind of kavanah is needed, I don't care what it is. For mitzvah, there has to be kavanah. If I'm speaking about a person blowing a shofar,
mm-hmm.
Well, if I just am sleepwalking and blowing a shofar, no. But if I've intentionally picked it, I have some kind of kavanah.
Intentionally, right? Picked it up for the purpose of
blowing the shofar.
Blowing the shofar.
Okay. I've had some intention.
Yeah.
Some intention. But somebody walking next to the room.
Right.
What kind of intention can we imagine?
Right.
The only intention we can possibly say is required, because listening is completely passive. You just hear it. You don't have to open your ears, even though our mothers tell us to do that, right? It just happens. And therefore, if we say some intention is required, I'm just emphasizing thinking a different way about saying it's different to be the blower and the listener.
Right. You're supporting these Rambam. So let me tell you that I think that's good what you said, but it is possible to look at it differently. The Gemara has a discussion exactly on what you're saying. Is there such a thing as passive and active listening? So the Gemara says there can be a case in which someone is walking by a synagogue and he hears a shofar blown, in a biological sense he hears it blown, but he wasn't paying attention, wasn't even paying attention to listen. And he doesn't really know that he heard anything. He was daydreaming. Mm-hmm. Similar to sleepwalking.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gemara brings up the possibility that as long as the intention to hear something, even though it was an intention to hear for the purpose of mitzvah, perhaps that's enough. So the Gemara actually does discuss that. Passive and active listening. Okay. Good. Good. I guess we could now go on to the two sources that I just brought in C, the Gemara and the Rashi, and then in D, which are simply sources that give us the Talmudic discussions of things we've discussed in the past 15 minutes. So D is Talmud Bavli, Tractate Rosh Hashanah, page 33b with Rashi, and that is the Gemara on our Mishnah. And what it says is, "Va'mitasek lo yatsa," which is a quote from our Mishnah, that someone who's mitasek didn't fulfill his obligation. Remember, I had said that it's possible to bring up the question, what does mitasek mean? Someone who didn't have intention for the mitzvah, or didn't have intention for something less, for the blowing?
I'm sorry, say again where you are?
C, okay.
Second source.
The second in C. Okay.
No, not the second in C.
Just the second source on the page.
Thank you. Okay.
So the Dibor Matril is Bamitasek Lo Yatsa. And the Gemara learns from that, Ha Tokea Lashir yetsa. Behold, the blower for music yetsa. In other words, if you tell me that the mitasek lo yetsa, and the assumption is mitasek means someone who didn't even intend for any sound to come out, it came out inadvertently. Ha! Behold, that teaches me that if I did intend to make a sound, even though the sound was only for shir, only for music, yetsa. Which is just, again, saying in four words what I said earlier in 40 sentences. So that would prove that mitzvot lo tzrichot kavana don't require kavana. All they require is to know you're doing an act. And then the Gemara says, if that's true, then lema messiah le l'rava, dama rava, hatokea l'shir yatsa. Translation, word for word. Lema means let us say, in Hebrew, lemor, say, messiah le, it helps to him to rava. But it's the conclusion we just came to, that tokea l'shir, blow to make music, yatsa, let's say that supports the position of Rava. Rava is a third and fourth generation Amora in Bavel. Dama Rava, as Rava used to say, hatokea l'shir yatsa. He used to say that tokea l'shir yatsa, because Rava took the position that mitzvot lo tzrichot kavana. All they require is that you're not a mitasek. You intend to do the action. And that is the preliminary conclusion of the Gemara. And that would mean that our Mishnah supports the position that mitzvot lo tzrichot kavana. But then the Gemara says, wait a second, I can interpret our Mishnah differently. I can interpret our Mishnah to mean, and this is the last word of the line, Dilma tokea l'shir nami mitasek karile. Perhaps that blowing from music also mitasek it's called. In other words, when the Mishnah said mitasek, perhaps it didn't mean someone who doesn't intend to get a sound out. Perhaps it means someone who intends to get a sound out, but he doesn't intend for the Mishnah, for the mitzvah. So I think that what the Gemara is saying is really, and what I was saying 10 minutes ago is the same thing. In other words, the Gemara says that the clear inference of Mishnah is that mitzvot don't require kavanah. Because mitasek doesn't mean lack of kavanah, it means something much more basic. Had it meant lack of kavanah, it would have said that. Mitasek means he didn't even intend to get a sound out. So that's the Gemara's first reading of the Mishnah. And that supports Rava that tokei l'shir yatsa, that if you intended to get a sound out even for music, yatsa, because you don't need kavanah. But the Gemara says, dilma, perhaps we could interpret it differently. If you have your back to the wall, you could interpret it differently. But the Gemara admitted that the most basic, simplest, straightforward interpretation is that mitasek just means he didn't mean to get a sound out, it came out accidentally, which proves that mitzvot lo tzrichot kavanah. And that indeed is the way the Rambam understands it, as according to the first intuition of the Gemara, and not the second effort to try to say something else. The second effort is just that, it's a second effort. The Gemara admits that the first approach, the easiest, the most straightforward, is that mitzvot lo tzrichot kavanah. Okay, so we don't have to read the Rashi, because Rashi just explains everything we just said. And that's all. Okay, so there's one more source, which is D, which I want to look at, on the same subject of mitasek. And it's not a direct explication of the pshat, it's simply an interesting digression. So here we go, this is D. Talmud Bavli, Tractate Rosh Hashanah, page 33a. It's again the Bavli on our Mishnah. And it says in the Dibur Matchil that the Gemara quotes from the Mishnah, Ein makvin et atinakot militkoa. We do not prevent the children from blowing, right? That's what the Mishnah said. And then the Gemara says, Ha nasim makvin. Behold, women, we do prevent. In other words, the assumption of the Gemara is that there are two basic categories of people with halachic disabilities, children and women. And if you told me that one of those groups, we don't prevent them from blowing Hoshana, that implies, since you didn't mention the other group, that implies the other group does have still the halachic disability. So that would imply that if we don't prevent children from blowing, there must be someone else that we do prevent, and that must be women. So the conclusion is that we can imply from this Mishnah that we prevent women from blowing. Why? Because women have no mitzvah of shofar. Right? It's a mitzvah to say shazman grama. It's a positive time-bound mitzvah. I know today we have a custom among Ashkenazim and even among most Sephardim that women come to the synagogue to hear, but really it's a mitzvah to say shazman grama and women are exempt. Women are exempt. Again, Ashkenazi women have taken upon themselves.
So just a small point.
Yeah, of course.
On occasion through the year, the rabbi will announce, and this is a mitzvah for men and women, and they have to, he doesn't say that for shofar?
What he will say is, women who haven't heard the shofar, there'll be a special shofar blowing. So the rabbi does imply that women are obligated. And
because it's the custom.
Because it's the custom.
Well, we announce that if anybody hasn't heard the shofar blowing, to say the appropriate bracha and then to listen.
And that is the custom among Ashkenazim, that women have taken the mitzvah upon themselves, and that women can take upon themselves positive time-bound mitzvot, and when they take these mitzvot upon themselves, they say the blessing because it's a voluntary obligation, to use the words of Tosfot. But amongst many Sephardi poskim, women don't say the blessing over any mitzvah they take upon themselves, and women are not encouraged to take mitzvot upon themselves, and even shofar. You certainly find Sephardi communities in which women don't listen, and if they would listen, wouldn't say the bracha. It goes so far among Ashkenazim that a man can go into a man who's already blown the shofar, heard the shofar, can go into a room of women and blow it for them. One of them will say the bracha, and he will blow. So.
Because otherwise he shouldn't be blowing the shofar if it's not for someone's mitzvah. Is that what you're implying?
He shouldn't be saying the bracha.
Oh, is he allowed to blow it if it's not for someone's mitzvah?
That's what we do. That's what he does. We do. We do that. A man will go into a room of women.
But I'm saying if it's not for someone's mitzvah. If it's not... In other words...
Okay, so that's the whole question of our Mishnah, right?
Well, that's what I... Okay.
Why do you let the kids blow? So it does seem to be that you let the kids blow even though they don't have a mitzvah, right?
Right.
And you teach them to blow, so that would mean that you could blow for a group of women, even Sephardi women.
But this is the children themselves blowing.
It's not clear. What does it mean, mit askimi mahem? What does it mean you do with them? Does it mean that you just instruct them how to do it, or you do blow yourself? It's to show them. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to mit aseki with them? It's not clear.
But our mission does not merely refrain from saying women can do it. It also refrains from saying men can practice the shofar. If there's a child that you're helping, yes. But on Rosh Hashanah, can you encourage me to practice blowing the shofar? This says no. I'm not a child. I don't know how. I'd like to learn. On Rosh Hashanah, this seems to say you're not allowed to encourage me to blow the shofar. Just like it doesn't say a woman can do it, nor...
It's not clear. It's not clear. Because it could be that it's saying that even though the kids are not obligated, since they will become obligated when they grow older, therefore it's good to encourage them to know how to blow the shofar. If that was the proper reading, then it would be all the more so is it good to encourage adult males to learn how to blow the shofar.
Even on the holiday itself.
Even on the holiday itself. But not women, because they are not obligated. I'm saying that's a possible reading.
Okay.
But yours is also possible. And the Gemara actually discusses something very similar. It discusses something very similar. As in
that
many
cases...
That was
the point of my question of saying, so if you've already blown the shofar in the sanctuary, and now there's some women who haven't heard yet, I understand the idea that you can blow for them because it's has a mitzvah purpose.
Yeah.
Blowing the shofar.
Yeah.
It has a mitzvah purpose. But if you're just, you couldn't, I guess I'm one, you can't go practice, can you?
You could certainly go practice if you're going
after,
to later.
No, after. You're all done. You just want to practice. Seems to me this says no. You're helping a child, yes, that's okay. You're blowing it for a mitzvah, yes, that's okay. Otherwise, what's
right.
the point of the Mishnah? The Mishnah is giving an exemption from the forbidden act.
Right.
So therefore, it's forbidden.
There, it's forbidden.
You're not allowed to just blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah if it's not for a mitzvah.
For no purpose.
For practice. There's a purpose of just practice.
For no mitzvah purpose.
Either. It seems like that's... If you don't say that, then the Mishnah doesn't have any point.
So what's the mitzvah purpose? To teach children? To get them connected to the mitzvah.
We always teach everything. Okay, so that's...
So isn't it the same thing with an adult male? If I want to teach an adult male on Rosh Hashanah?
Well, then why doesn't the Mishnah say, if somebody wants to learn, they can practice and teach just for teaching? That's good.
Because then I might think that you could teach an adult male, but not a child, because a child is not presently obligated. In other words, if I say that you can teach a child who's not presently obligated, then I might say, all the more so can I teach an adult male who's already obligated. It's a director connection to the mitzvah. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm saying that you can say what I'm saying, you can say what you're saying. It really can go both directions.
Yeah, okay.
By the way, all this implies that when it says you can teach the kids, only male kids, right? Because the female kids will never grow up to be obligated. That would be the implication.
A woman, is this part of the rule, a woman can't blow the shofar for a man to fulfill the
right.
mitzvah. Is that correct?
Right,
that's
exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Just like a child can't, a woman can, neither of them are obligated.
And therefore can't.
And even if you say that women are obligated in the sense they've taken upon themselves, it's still not the same level of obligation mm-hmm. as a male.
Would a woman be able to blow the shofar at all? So
for other women?
For herself or for other women?
The answer to that is that b'fashtut, you know, on a simple, if you look at it straightforwardly, it's hard to find any reason why a woman would not be allowed to blow for herself or for other women. But there still are achronim that forbid it. It's a similar question. Can women read the Megillah for themselves on Purim? And simply speaking, it's hard to see a reason why not. But there are achronim that forbid a woman from reading for women.
Are women obligated to hear? I thought they are obligated to hear the Megillah. Or is that a similar...
So, according to the... Actually, I shouldn't have brought the example of Megillah, because Megillah is more complicated. According to the Pshat of the Mishnah, women are obligated in the Megillah. Mm-hmm. But there's a Tosefta that seems to indicate that women's obligation in the Megillah is a different obligation than men's obligation.
Okay.
And therefore, mm-hmm. yeah. So we are now in D from the beginning.
We didn't record all that, did we?
Yeah. We don't prevent the children from blowing. That's a quote from the Mishnah. Says the Gemara, Ha Nashim, behold Nashim, Makvin, we do prevent. Vahatanya. But we learned in a Braita. Hatanya means but we learned in a Braita. Ein ma'akvin et anashim, lo et anashim, velo et atinokot militkoa beyom tov. we don't prevent not the women and not the men from, and not the tinokot from blowing on Yom Tov. So in other words, we have now a contradiction. Our Mishnah says we don't prevent the tinokot. A brayta says we don't prevent the tinokot and we don't prevent the women. So there seems to be a machloket whether we prevent women or don't prevent women from blowing on Rosh Hashanah. So now we're looking for an answer to the contradiction. And Abaye says, I know an answer. Amar Abaye, lo kasha, it's not difficult. Ha Rabbi Yehuda, ha Rabbi Yossi the Rabbi Shimon. That source is Rabbi Yehuda. The other source is Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon. In other words, Abaye sees in this possible machloket between a bright and a Mishnah concerning the question of women being allowed to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, he sees in a reflection of an earlier, more basic ideological argument between Rabbi Yehuda on the one hand and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon on the other hand. And here is the presentation now of the earlier, more basic argument. And it's the last word of the line, Detanya, as we learned in the Braita. And the Braita begins by quoting a verse from the book of Leviticus, Vayikra. And all the verse says is, Debel B'nai Yisrael, speak to B'nai Yisrael. And it's the second verse of the book of Leviticus. And it says that God spoke to Moses saying, right, Vayikra Shema Moshe Mi'ol Moed Limor, Debel B'nai Yisrael. And all the mitzvot of the korbanot of the Mishkan begin with God saying, speak to B'nai Yisrael. And look at what the Braita says. B'nai Yisrael somchim ve'ein b'not Yisrael somchot. Male Yisraelim do the mitzvah of smicha, of somchim, and b'not Yisrael don't. So what's going on? What we're doing is we're taking the mitzvah of smicha. The mitzvah of smicha means laying on of hands. And it refers to the fact that anyone who brings a sacrifice, an olah, shlamim, a hatat, lays his hands upon it, and it shows connection, even identity, transfer of identity in the case of a hatat, like you bring the animal in place of yourself. There's a mitzvah of smicha, that you lay your hands on the korban that you bring. And the Braita says, men do that and women don't do it. Why don't women do it? Because all the mitzvot of the korbanot, including smicha, are introduced by the phrase that says, speak to B'nai Yisrael. And the Midrash says, B'nai Yisrael and not B'not Yisrael. Now I understand that there are many other cases in which we don't make that Midrash, in which B'nai Yisrael means all of the Jews. But here that distinction is made. So it means to say that all the mitzvot of the korbanot and smicha singled out as the main mitzvah that a layman does with his korban, which is he lays his hands upon it there in the entrance to the Beit HaMikdash, that's for men and not for women. Women can bring a korban, but they don't do smicha. And then it says, Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. That was Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. Now the last two words of the line, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon Omrim, and it's still part of the Braita, Nashim Somchot Rashut. Women lay hands upon voluntarily. So what that means is that Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon also agree that the drasha excludes women from the obligation of smicha, but they say that women can do it voluntarily, implying that where Rabbi Yehuda said that women don't do it, he meant they can't do it. So to summarize, we seem to have an agreement that women are not obligated in the mitzvah of smicha. But then we have an argument, are they allowed to do it, or are they forbidden from doing it? And that's a fundamental argument of the Tanaim. Now by the way, what I mentioned 5 minutes ago about the difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardim concerning women on Shofar comes from here. It all goes back to this machloket, more or less, that there's a trend in tradition that says a mitzvah that women are not obligated in, they're not allowed. It's not theirs. It's meaningless for women. And another trend that says that a mitzvah that women are not obligated in doesn't mean that there's no meaning for women to do the mitzvah, but they do it voluntarily and not obligatorily. And the machloket in the Middle Ages between Ashkenazi and Sephardi poskim concerning women and mitzvot aseh shezman grama goes back to, among other things, to this exchange right here. So anyway, now that we have that exchange here, why did Abaye say that it's relevant to what's going on in the machloket between our Mishnah and the Braita concerning do you prevent women or not prevent them from blowing the shofar in Rosh Hashanah? Well, if you take the position that says, this is Rabbi Yehuda's position, that women not only are not obligated to do smicha on the korban, but they're not allowed, so the extrapolation of that is that women are not allowed to do any mitzvah that they're not obligated in. If they're not allowed to do any mitzvah, it means women are not allowed to listen to the shofar. I don't know if it goes that far, not allowed to listen, but certainly not allowed to blow. So if women are never allowed to blow, certainly I'm not going to allow them to fool around with the shofar and Rosh Hashanah. But if you take the position of Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon that says that women, it's true, cannot be obligated, cannot be considered obligated to lay hands upon the korban, but they are allowed to if they want, the implication is that any mitzvah that women are exempt from, they can do if they want. And it has mitzvah value. So that would mean that if women want to blow the shofar and Rosh Hashanah, whether for the blowing, whether to practice, they can do it because they are related to the mitzvah. So it's their mitzvah, although it's not obligatory mitzvah, it's a voluntary mitzvah. That's the story. Yeah. And now we have probably half an hour to the last Mishnah of the Masechet. Well, actually only 9 minutes. But we have to finish the Masechet because we said we're going to do that today. So I guess we'll do it a little bit quickly. The last Mishnah...
We need another copy of the second Masechet.
This is a Mishnah that appears to be quite straightforward, whereas the Gemara makes it very, very, very complicated. And the truth is I've been bothered by this for 20 years, why the Gemara makes it so complicated, and I don't have an answer. But we'll learn the simple, straightforward meaning of this Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Seder Tikiot Shalosh Shel Shalosh Shalosh. The order of blowing is 3 of 3, 3. That's not complicated. The expression 3, 3 means 3 each. We've had the expression earlier. We don't have time to look at it. So it says the order of blowing is 3 of 3 each, which means 3 sets of 3. Altogether 9, right? 3 sets of 3 is 9. When you blow the shofar, it's 3 sets of 3. And we've learned earlier that the blowing of the shofar in Rosh Hashanah used to be intrinsically connected to Musaf, and only part of Musaf. And Musaf, we learned, has Malchiot, Zichronot, and Shofarot. And we learned that what they would do is they blow the shofar during the saying of the Shmona Esrei. And that's what it's saying here. There are 3 blasts for Malchiot, 3 for Zichronot, and 3 for Shofarot. And it's simple. It's simple. Shiur Tikia Kishalosh Truot. Shiur Trua Kishalosh Yibavot. That gets mathematical. It says the Shiur of a Tikia equals 3 Truot. And the shiur of a trua equals 3 yibavot. So this is the phrase the Gemara spends pages making complicated. And I don't know why. Professor Albeck says that it's really simple what it means. And what it means is as follows. We're talking about how long in time should the 3 different types of shofar blasts last. And we have 3 different types. We have the tikiah, right, which is a straight sound. And then we have another sound that's ah, ah, ah. And then we have a third that's da, 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 da. And it seems like, according to this Mishnah, the phraseology is that the sound that's ah, ah, ah is called a trua. Today we don't use that word. We use that word for something else. And the sound that is da, 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 is called the yibava. And what it's saying is the tikiya equals shalosh truel. In other words, the du lasts for the same amount of time as it takes to do a trua, and a trua is du du du. So it's very simple that if each du du du, it's 2 seconds each, altogether 6 seconds. So the trua is 6 seconds, and the tikiya equals that. 6 seconds is the tikiya. Each chua is 2 seconds. Du, du, du. Three of those, which is what you do, is the same amount of time as the tikiya. And then it says, the chua, du, 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 equals shalosh yibavot, which means each one of those three, du, 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 takes the amount of time that it takes to make three yibavot, du-du-du. Now in the du-du-du, you do 9 of them. So each three, you do 3 of them 3 times, that's 9. And each of the 3 parts of the du-du-du, each of those 3 parts equals, in its time, each one of them equals 3 of the du-du-du. There are 9 of the du-du-du, which is the same amount of time it takes to make 3 of the du du du, which is the same amount of time it takes to take the one du for the tikiya. It's so, right, so it's, Dr. Jorat?
No.
It's pretty simple. To me it's complicated because I know all what the Gemara did to this, and there must be some tradition that the Gemara had that we don't know about today that caused the Gemara not to understand this in a simple sense. In the end, what I'm telling you is the way the halacha works out. That the trua is supposed to be as long as the three di-di-di-di-di and the di-di-di is supposed to be as long as the 9 di-di-di-di-di-di-di. That's where the halacha is, what I'm telling you. And that's what the pshat seems to be. But the Gemara took a long path to get there. The third part of the Mishnah, taka b'rishona u'mashach v'shnia chishtayim. Ein biyado elachat. He blew a tikiya, right, taka. He blew the tikiya at the beginning, barishana. Umashach bishnia chishtaim. And he elongated, he pulled it, mashach, he elongated bishnia at the second time, like 2. That I'm gonna draw, because what happens is that we said that there are 3 sets of 3. So what are the 3 sets of 3? The 3 sets of 3 are and I'm using the Mishnaic language. Tikiya. Oh, I'm sorry. Tikiya. Okay. Tikiya. 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 And this has a tirua. And this has a yibava. So we have 3 sets of 3. The first is tikiya, tikiya, tikiya. The second is tikiya, trua, tikiya. We say the trua is, according to the language of the Mishnah, du, du, du. And the third is tikiya, yibava, tikiya, yibava, du, 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 du. In other words, the principle is that we have to make a tikiya, a trua, and a yibava. And when we do them, we surround them on each side by an introduction and a closing. Tikiya and tikiya, tikiya and tikiya, tikiya, tikiya. So one of these will be for Malchiot, one for Zichronot, one for Shofrot. That's what they did at the time of the Mishnah. So now it says, and I'm going to read the Mishnah that we just read again. It says, Taka b'rishana, he did a tikiyah at the beginning. And then it said, Mashach b'shnia, he elongated the second one, like two. What it means is that this tikiyah, he wanted to use for this tikiyah. He made this one double length, so it could be for this one as well. Of course, that means it wasn't the framework of tefillah. The framework of tefillah, this is during Malchiot, this is Zichronot, this is Shofarot.
So one set, of course, each line that you've written corresponds to one particular segment only.
That's what it would be in the time of the Mishnah. Mm-hmm. So apparently this was done outside the framework of tefillah, and some smart aleck said, I'll make the tikiyah double length, so this tikiyah could serve also for this tikiyah. So that's what the Mishnah says, Ein biyado elahat. He doesn't have in his hand anything but one. It can't work. It can't count for two. It only counts for one. But it's a complication. The language of the Mishnah was, he did the first tikiyah, and he elongated the second as two, right? And the halakha only has only one in his hand. What does it mean, only one? Does it mean this one or only this one?
I don't get you. Does it
says he blew
is,
this one.
Are you allowed to make it too long?
Right.
Okay.
Right. He
if
did
made
this
it too
one.
Long, it didn't count.
At all. At all for that, only that. So this is a big machloket. And you look in the language, it's not clear what it means. Because if it means that this one, it was elongated to this one, and he only has this one, why did it mention that he also made this one? Just don't mention it. Why did it mention this one? Why did it mention this one? Because it means to tell you that he only has this one and not this one at all. And like David said, the nafkamina of these two ways of learning it is, are you allowed to blow too long? If you say that it means he only has this one, means he blew it too long, it can count for this one as well, but it does count for this one, teaching you you're allowed to blow as long as you want. But if the correct reading is that he doesn't have anything but this one, then it means because he did this one too long, he ruined the equilibrium, right? It's all supposed to be the same length. He doesn't even have this one, teaching you that there's not only a minimum length, there's also a maximum length.
So why shouldn't he have nothing if in that case? So
this one he made the proper length of.
But the middle...
Since... If it means he only has this one, mm-hmm. and this one is completely disqualified, he has to make this one again in order to close
he
off the set
the middle,
of...
It's ignoring the fact that he blew
right,
the middle one.
Right. He made
it's
the middle
ignoring
one.
That.
So the middle one is still valid in terms of completing the three pieces.
Yeah.
It's not even saying he blew it.
Yes.
It's just...
Obviously he blew it. We're just talking about the bookends now.
Okay, so it either counted despite being too long, but didn't count for the second row.
Right. Or it didn't even count for the end of the first row.
But the first two segments of that first row are still valid.
Right. Now to go back and blow another tikiyah less long.
Okay.
Not as long. Those would be the two ways of learning it. The halakha is according to the more lenient approach. That he does have this one in his hand, even though it was too long. The halakha is you are allowed to blow tikiyot as long as you want.
Mm-hmm.
There is no ceiling. There's only a minimum. Yeah. Okay. And now it says, when the middle of the third line, Mishabirach v'harkach nitmana lo shofar tokea umeria v'tokea shalosh pa'amim. Someone who blessed and later occasion to him a shofar, tokeya, and meriya, and tokeya shalosh pa'amim. What that means is the following. Someone blessed the blessings of Musaf, and they didn't have a shofar, and later occasion to them a shofar. In other words, the right way to do it, as we know, is that the shofar blowing is part of Musaf. But this person didn't have a shofar. So they said Musaf without a shofar, and lay their occasion to them a shofar. What you do now is blow the 9 shofar blasts, even though you already finished davening. Tokeo miria tokeya. It means you do a tokeya, and then you do what's in the middle between the tikiot, and then another tokeya. Do that shalosh pamim. Altogether 9. What you should have done in Musaf, you do after the end of Musaf. Now, you might say, wait a second, that's obvious. What's the chidush? In other words, I know I'm supposed to blow in the framework of davening, but I didn't have a shofar, so I davened, and now a shofar came. Well, obviously I'm going to blow it because there's a mitzvah to blow today. So what's the chidush? Anyone have an idea what's the chidush? What? How could the halakha have been different? What's
say Musaf again.
Yeah, that helped you know. That's very good. Right, say Musaf again, because you might say Musaf is no value without the tikiot. If you didn't have a shofar, okay, you do it to go through the motions, but you didn't fulfill the obligation. The havamina is that Musaf has no halakhic value without shofar blowing. And the maskana is it does have value. You don't have to say Musaf again. Even though lahatchila, you are supposed to say Musaf with the shofar blasts, but...
You could say the reason the other way around.
What do you mean?
You said Musaf has no value without the shofar. You could say the shofar has no value
without Musaf. No, I can't say that. I can't say that. Because the Torah says blow the shofar. I couldn't say that as...
Well, it doesn't say same Musaf.
Yeah, it doesn't. But I could say that when the rabbis instituted the mitzvah of Musaf, they only instituted it as part and together with the shofar. If you don't have the shofar, there's no value to it. But I could say. No, it's so funny.
Okay.
You're thinking we can say whatever we want. That's what you're thinking, right?
Was in the time of the Beit HaMikdash the shofar blowing attached to the Musaf sacrifice?
That's something else. That's completely different. That's a passage in Bamidbar that says that you blow the shofar over your sacrifices, but that's not related to Rosh Hashanah.
Okay.
And it's true in the Beit HaMikdash there was trumpet blowing and shofar blowing on the Musaf sacrifices of the Chagim or even on Shabbat, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. But that's a different shofar blowing than this shofar blowing. This is the shofar blowing of Rosh Hashanah.
Did that...
Was that connected to the sacrifices?
Even just not linked necessarily as some, even just time-wise, in the same way that we would for davening now.
I have no idea. I have absolutely no
idea. But don't we believe that during the time of the temple, people would blow the shofar for Rosh Hashanah at homes or away from the temple? That it was done
certainly,
regardless of
right.
giving a sacrifice.
Right, it's not one of the pilgrimage festivals.
Right.
So the mitzvah, right, so the mitzvah seems to be unrelated to the Beit HaMikdash.
Yeah, I was wondering about the practice in the Beit HaMikdash.
So what was the practice in the Beit HaMikdash? I think I have no idea. Mm-hmm. That goes into the whole sticky historical question of what was the place of tefillah in the Beit HaMikdash, which is a question we don't really know a lot about.
Well, not even specifically tefillah, because there's no, this is just, you know, korban plus or not.
Right, well, you're right. You're right, it doesn't have to be connected. I'm assuming it's connected, so I'm assuming that shofar and musaf are always connected. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so I don't know. The last part of the Mishnah seems to be a closing of the whole Masechet and not just related to what we've been discussing recently, and we'll read it briefly. Kishem, it's the last word of a line, Kishem Shashaliach Tzibur Chayav Kach Kol Yachid V'Yachid Chayav. Just like the Shaliach Tzibur is obligated, so is every individual and individual obligated. It seems to be not talking about Rosh Hashanah and not talking about Tekiat Shofar. It seems to be talking about Tefillah in general. And it seems to be saying that just like the Shliach Tzibur has to daven, so every individual has to daven. Now it's interesting that what seems to be the baseline obligation is the Shliach Tzibur, and the individual obligation seems to be a function of that, right? Just like the Shliach Tzibur is obligated, so is the individual obligated. Right? In our times, we tend to think that the individual Shmona Esrei is the main thing, and the Shmona Esrei is repeated by the Shliach Tzibur, and it's kind of superfluous. Here we get the opposite impression. Shliach Tzibur, that's the real davening, and I'm telling you, individuals also have to daven, but it's the Shliach Tzibur that's the main thing. And then Rabbi Gamliel says that Shliach Tzibur motzi et rabim yedei chovatan. Rabbi Gamliel says that the Shliach Tzibur helps the individuals, the rabim, to do their obligation, meaning there's no such thing as the silent Shmona Esrei. Right? The pshat here is that Rabbi Gamliel holds what Jewish prayer is one person saying it out loud for everyone else. Whereas the Tanakhama says, no, I agree with you, the Shliach Tzibur is the main thing, but we also have instituted individual davening for everyone. That's the pshat of the Mishnah. The Gemara has a slightly different take on it. The Gemara says that even Rabbi Gamliel agrees that there's such a thing as a silent Shmona Esrei. But Rabbi Gamliel says that if you don't say the silent Shmona Esrei, the Shliach Tzibur fulfills your obligation for you, just by you listening. Whereas the Tanakhama says that the Shliach Tzibur cannot fulfill the obligation for the Yechidim except if they don't know how to say it themselves. So the Gemara is saying the same thing as I said, but in a more, in a less radical fashion. But the pshat seems to be, just to say it once again, there is no such thing as a silent prayer according to Rabban Gamliel, whereas according to the Tanakhama there is such a thing as a silent prayer, but it seems still to be secondary to the main thing, which is the Shliach Tzibur saying his. And why that is here, what's it related to this chapter and to this Masechet, I don't know. I guess if I had more time to prepare and we had more time together, we would talk a lot about that. With that, we have finished.
So this isn't just about Musaf either.
It seems not to be about Musaf, not to be at Rosh Hashanah specifically. It seems to be about everything. General statement.
And it doesn't even seem to be playing off some words that came before it, as we've seen in the past, where
right.
You mention words, so you say something like it's unrelated substantively, but it's related by word. Am I wrong?
Yeah. What have we been talking about that there's any connection to?
Whether the children, you know, code are obligated or not. That's the only thing I can.
That was shofar, whereas
yeah,
this is tefillah.
No,
it's pretty
no
strange. It's pretty strange. Yeah, so I admit I haven't thought about it, simply because of a lack of time. And that's the type of question that really I would like to give a lot of time to.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because that's about the structure and what you can learn from the structure. And I'm sure there's an answer to the question, what it's telling us. We'd have to go through the whole Masechet now and see what the structure is that the editor is trying to put together for us.
You know, on occasion, Art Scroll will footnote an inner, you know, here in Art Scroll, it says, the Mishnah concludes with a ruling concerning prayer.
Mm-hmm.
They insert
mm-hmm.
that and then have this Mishnah.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they'll put a footnote saying, this is here because it relates to, or it gives some reason why something that seems different is there. There's no footnote here.
Yeah.
There's no hint about why this is here.
Yeah, I assume the answer would be found in looking at the overall structure of the whole Masechet.
Yeah.
So we have time for next time we do Masechet Rosh Hashanah, the 7, 8, 9 years. Okay.